This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
O'clock update. It is Rick Wolf with the Sports Edge program here on The Fan. Ed Randall's Talking Baseball is along after our 9 o'clock update this and every Sunday morning at this time of the year. We move into what should be a wide-ranging and interesting discussion with a guest who has joined us a number of times previously. We always like when we have discussions with the chairman for Mainstream Mental Health, Dr. John Huber. He is joining us on our program. And we're going to get into talking about a couple of interesting areas. First of all, Dr. Huber, I hope you've been well. Welcome to our program.
Well, thank you for having me back on, Bob. I'm doing great.
For those who don't know, a little bit of background here on the organization. How do you describe what Mainstream Mental Health is about?
Well, our whole goal essentially is tied up in our name. We want to make the discussion about mental health mainstream. We want people to be able to talk about it. The more we know, the more information we have, and the more understanding that it's really just part of being human and not necessarily something to be afraid of.
Okay. Now, as you say that, I've been thinking in the past week about a number of folks who live in the state of Texas where you live, because there's a major story that has been in the news in recent weeks. Interestingly enough, the story was much larger in focus in the area of the country where you live in Texas than it was here, for, I guess, obvious reasons. But then within the past week to 10 days, it kind of exploded nationally. And that's the story surrounding this, what's referred to as the Austin area serial bomber, who had taken his life when he was being pursued by police who had tracked him as he was moving. Reports are that he actually detonated a bomb and took his life as a couple of police officers were approaching the vehicle that he was driving. As that story developed, and we think about this idea of mental health, give us some insight on how it is that you viewed this person.
Well, it is kind of interesting, but essentially what this person was a serial killer. So they just chose an explosive device instead of strangling or using a gun or a knife to kill their target. And, he moved from being relatively pointed in his attack he actually had a list of people and addresses that he was sending bombs to. He delivered them, the first three of them, by hand. The fourth one, his MO or modus operandi had been identified by the police, and they were looking for someone just taking packages. So he changed that MO and set up a trip line on what essentially was part of a hike and bike trail where a mother and her stroller could have been a victim, as it was two adult men were the victims. And he became very indiscriminate from being very targeted in his mechanism and his plan. And then he decided to go back to being, targeting the victims, and he tried to use an established mail carrier to target the victims again. Only he didn't understand what was going on in the automated systems, and one of the arms that actually would push the package over onto a different track for a different mail route, hit one of the bombs and triggered the mechanism itself, as opposed to actually having to have somebody open the flap and flip the switch that way. At which point, because of the mechanism involved, he was easily tracked. The computer, you know, we knew exactly, or the police and FBI knew exactly who paid for what and where, and it was just a matter of time at that point to get caught. So essentially, he was a psychopath, a sociopath.
And when we use that term, a lot of us have heard it. What exactly does that mean? What exactly is a psychopath or sociopath?
In simple terms, it's someone who has no conscience and only values human life from what he can get out of that life. And in this case, he was getting a sense of control and empowerment. And he got a lot of control out of watching, you know, the city here and the surrounding area, over a million people, changing their lifestyle patterns and acting out of fear. And that's very powerful for a young person who's never had a sense of control in his life and was feeling a lot of inability to affect the outcome of his life at that current time.
There's so many troubling aspects of this story, but you know, I kind of alluded to this in introducing this aspect of the discussion and introducing you. What has it been like in Texas, and I guess especially too in that area surrounding Austin, in this period of time where, you know, people have kind of, I'm assuming, been sort of walking on eggshells?
Well, you know, it's like I have two teenage children, and one of the concerns that I've heard a lot of, because at least in one of the cases, a teenage son picked up a package and opened it up once he got it inside, and unfortunately he died from that. But, you know, I hear it from my kids' friends, their families, and I hear it in the grocery store when I got my hair cut, people talking about, you know, they're just not buying things online. They're actually, we're going to some of the big box stores and stuff like that instead of ordering stuff like they had been, because they were afraid that it might, you know, be an opportunity for the bomber to actually strike at them. And there was a lot of fear and concern. I mean, we had South by Southwest going on
right
during this time frame, and we were lucky that he didn't, you know, attack during those 9 days, but we had a copycat person who emailed in a bomb threat and actually shut down South by Southwest the last Saturday evening. And it was interesting to watch the visitors to our city. I was involved somewhat with South by Southwest, and they were much more relaxed and nonchalant, but the people from Austin were much more controlled in their movements, kind of vigilant and, you know, checking things out a little more than normal. It was kind of somber in a lot of ways, but it was good to have that. And it was also good that we didn't really have an issue over those 9 days. And I think that's when that next bomb that went off that injured two men on the bike path, that kind of hit us really hard, and immediately there was a big change in behavior that afternoon, or the next day, actually. So,
part of the discussion also has to surround this idea that it seems an increasing number of relatively young people are becoming involved in actions that are deadly, drastic, and their regard for human life seems to be almost non-existent. I mean, is that a fair characterization?
That is a fair categorization and behavior angle that most sociopaths actually have. And the reality of it is it's a very small portion of our population, but let's say, you know, it's less than 0.1% of our population. Every year our population grows, so the sheer numbers grow. And at 330 million people, that gives us almost 3 million people in this country with those types of belief sets, or lack of consciousness that we talked about earlier, and they're going to act. It doesn't take a lot of people to cause trauma in as a society in that situation, and that's unfortunate because an individual can have that kind of significant thing. But you got some key elements that we see that are very common. These individuals tend to be that make their mark, whether it's Ted Bundy or the Austin bomber, is that they have very high levels of intelligence. They have an inability to maintain long-term close personal relationships, an inability to maintain long-term productive work. And an interesting thing that we're seeing now is kind of a catalyst, is we're seeing an absentee father in their lives when they were growing up. Now, that doesn't mean, for example, that a single mother can't take that role on, or that, you know, we have to have a mother-father parenting system. But what we know is that two parents is significantly better for an individual than having one parent. So even if that parent, both parents are of same sex, that two-parent parenting mechanism is much more effective when these individuals are troubled like this. And we have, as a society, become more and more single parents. You know, 50% of our marriages end up in divorce. We have, you know, somewheres around 60 to 70% of individuals as children experience a divorce situation for parents. And it's hard not to have repercussions from that. And this is part of it.
You know, as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking about a number of different things. You mentioned Ted Bundy, and I've been thinking about Ted Bundy as we're speaking, because, you know, you use that term sociopath or psychopath, and he seems to fit the role perfectly when you stop and think about it. And very, very disturbing that people can be so demonic in their beliefs and in their actions and their disregard for others and for human life. But the other aspect of this is, especially with this young man, and his name is Mark Anthony Condit, this idea of when somebody's cornered, they take their own lives. I mean, detonating a bomb, that's not going to end well, obviously.
No.
What's prompting this desire for these folks to check out?
Well, what we're seeing is, whether it's, you know, when somebody goes in, for example, the Florida high school shooting, when somebody goes into that kind of a mechanism or situation, their anticipation is that they're not going to come out alive. Ted Bundy, as a serial killer, he believed he was truly smarter than all the police forces out there, than the FBI, and didn't believe that anybody was going to catch him. But he also was very close and personal with his killing. I mean, he was there, and if you get to see his interviews, if you read his statements, he was getting turned on emotionally, sexually, physically, by physically taking the life from an individual. And he was not afraid to face his detractors and people who went after him.
Exactly.
When you're looking at these, and that's a big change with these serial killers today and mass killers today. In that a lot of them are like, no. I want to check out the way I want to check out. I don't want to have to spend my life in prison or give somebody else the quote-unquote pleasure of taking my life. So they've got an exit strategy where they're in control. And I think that's the key factor right there, especially with this Austin bomber, is that control. He got to choose not only his targets, how they were going to die or be maimed, but his end was there. Now, in his diatribe, 25-minute recorded diatribe that he goes on, he tries to paint himself as some sort of victim You know, poor me. I was at a dead end job, dead end life. I was going nowhere. And I argue that there's tens of thousands, if not, you know, hundreds of thousands of Americans who are on in that situation. Yet he chose to go and take lives and harm people, and all those other people don't. This individual was significantly frayed as far as his value of life and his lack of taking responsibility for this whole thing. And that's where using the bombs and having an exit strategy of taking his own life shows that lack of responsibility that a lot of people are directing towards the millennials of not being responsible for their behavior, expecting people to take care of them, entitlement. I don't believe that all millennials feel that way.
Okay, well, I want to follow up on a couple of different things that you said.
Okay,
Let's take a pause in our discussion. There's so many different areas where we can go. We'll also try to work in some thoughts from some of the folks listening to us, too. It's Sunday morning on The Fan. Good morning, everybody. This is Bob Salter, and we're in discussion with Dr. John Huber on our program. Dr. Huber is a chairman for Mainstream Mental Health, Mainstream Mental Health, that's all as one word, .org, the website for the nonprofit organization. And he is a mental health professional. He's a clinical forensic psychologist. He is talking with us this hour of our program. We're going to go into a couple of different areas. I should mention, too, if you want to join us in the discussion, you can. 877-337-6666. That's our number here at WFAN. We started off in this hour talking about some of the aftermath of this situation with the young man who's been labeled the Austin serial bomber. Mark Anthony Condit is his name. He took his life last week as he had been pulled over to the side of the road. He was being followed, had been tracked by police. And there were several police officers approaching the vehicle that he was driving. And at that time, apparently he detonated a bomb inside the vehicle and took his own life. And we're talking about this whole idea of serial killers. Dr. Huber is providing us with some insight on that. Also shared a little bit of thought about Ted Bundy in this discussion. Believe me, we could go hours just on Ted Bundy because that's a very, very bizarre case and individual. But in this case, what was it like for the people that you're seeing, the people that you're working with, patients, during this period of time when bombs were being detected, bombs were going off?
For my patients directly, I have some patients who have significant anxiety issues, and they were less willing to leave the house, more isolating. They were afraid, and that their anxiety was exacerbated. I have some patients with post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, and it was bringing back some of them to the stimulus that caused them. A lot of veterans who were in you know, battlefields and areas like Afghanistan and Iraq, and having IEDs blowing up all around them at different times without warning. And they were having some increased levels of tension and stress in their lives. And at the same time, I feel for, and I know that some of the FedEx employees are going to have issues similar to post-traumatic stress disorder, if not fully developing that. And it may not be for weeks, months, maybe even a year or more out before they actually start manifesting some of the symptomology. But so can people within the community that was targeted. These stresses aren't isolated to just the people that were actually blown up, but the terror was within the community.
Is there still terror and fear surrounding the idea that there could be other explosives out there?
You know, it's kind of interesting. Since his demise, there has been a great sense of relief. People are laughing more in public, and it's interesting. I spend a lot of time out in public, and I have kids that are active in social activities, you know, choirs, band activities, high school activities, and it's just a much more positive feeling within, you know, a day of the bomber being caught and dying.
Interesting. That is interesting because I know that there was such a strong sense of fear in that area. And, you know, part of that fear surrounded the idea that nobody knew exactly what might happen next. And initially there was some thought about even if he took his own life, could there be other bombs out there?
That was a big fear specifically, you know, but in his memoirs or whatever, he said 7 bombs and he had the last one. However, when the police got to his house, they evacuated 5 square blocks because there were so many explosives in there. They were concerned for the immediate vicinity and possible loss of life there. So I think he had a lot bigger plans than what happened, but he, again, had those plans cut short because of exactly what should have happened. Homeland Security acted the way it was supposed to act and got all the policing agencies interconnected and working together. It was actually quite impressive to watch from here.
And, you know, this idea of people who, individuals, who store huge amounts of weaponry, huge amounts of explosives in their homes. I mean, first of all, that's dangerous to them, but it's also showing rather callous disregard for the people in their community. I mean, to a rational person, we've got to think, wait a minute, what are they thinking? Don't they realize that this basically could blow up a neighborhood?
Exactly. And most people with explosives that actually have access to them are actually licensed to have access to them. It's, you know, you have to go through a vetting process and actually get a license for that. I actually have a friend of mine whose father is an explosives expert, and he's testified in court many a times. The only type of explosive besides a small amount of like gunpowder, for example, or a binomial or two-part explosive that the average person get, there's by name brand, it's called Tannerite, and it's used to identify a great distance whether you hit a target or not, because it takes a high rate of friction. You can't light that explosive up. It has to actually be hit with the projectile going at least 2,000 feet per second to cause ignition, because there has to be that compression and friction involved in it. So it's a very specialized type of explosive. That's the only one that I'm aware of that is legal besides, you know, small amounts of gunpowder. So this gentleman was, you know, far beyond what I would call the average, for example, gun owner who may have, you know, ammunition in a safe with their guns and things like that. This was an extreme case. And it was, again, someone who didn't care about the laws. And unfortunately, if you know basic chemistry, there is enough chemical agents that are freely purchased in this country and in most countries that you can make explosives if you just have a little bit of chemical understanding and knowledge and can you know, work through a chemistry process. So it's not something that is going to go away, but it also takes a little bit of knowledge and work to get there. So it's not like you can go down to Walmart and buy a bag of it.
Fortunately,
definitely.
Acts of violence. You know, seeing this in the numbers that we are, you know, all these different school shootings taking place, is this a form of addiction?
I don't think it's a form of addiction. Actually, the rates and numbers of mass shootings and serial killings, for example, of the homicides, it's less than 0.1% of homicides that occur annually in this country. It's a very small portion. The problem is it is so dramatic and scary because it hits us at our weakest points, and it becomes a major fear factor for us. So it seems very overwhelming, and it definitely sells media and drives emotions. So people tend to react emotionally instead of react rationally. You know, my understanding, you know, rifle or long gun deaths in this country, you know, there are fewer of those than people who actually get beaten by hammers to death every year. So, you know, if we start putting things in perspective, we start acting more rationally. And, you know, as a forensic psychologist, oftentimes I'm brought in on really horrific cases, and I get asked by judges to explain behavior, and I have to step away from however heinous that crime is and break it down into the harsh realities that, you know, some people think, oh, you're minimizing the significance of this death. But if we're going to actually change behavior and try to make this a better place, we have to step away from that irrational part of us, our emotions, and figure out not what we want, but what we need to do to make these changes. And it's a very difficult thing to do as a person.
The voice of Dr. John Huber, who is our guest this hour of our program. He is chairman for Mainstream Mental Health on the web at mainstreammentalhealth.org. That's all as one word, .org. It's a nonprofit organization. We're going to talk more with you, Dr. Huber, as we continue. If you want to join us in the discussion, you can. 877-337-6666 is our number here at The Fan. After 8 o'clock, it is Rick Wolf, who's along with the Sports Edge program. And Ed Randall is by after our 9 o'clock update this Sunday morning. It's the Sports Edge program with Rick Wolf that follows our 8 o'clock update on The Fan this Sunday morning. I'm Bob Salter. We're in discussion with Dr. John Huber on our program. Dr. Huber is a clinical forensic psychologist. He's the chairman for Mainstream Mental Health and has been talking with us since we started the 7 o'clock hour of our program. We were talking about the whole case with the serial killer in Austin, Texas, the Austin bomber, and talking a little bit about this idea of serial killers and sociopaths, psychopaths. Let's shift our discussion over to another aspect of mental health in discussion. And here we use the D word, depression. This depression I want to talk about in a couple of different areas. One, in the workplace. And a lot of people probably don't like to think about that. Some people may not even want to talk about it. Do we have any idea how prevalent depression is in the workplace?
In the workplace, the research suggests that 1 out of 10 people at work are expressing depressive symptomology, and that leads to decreased workload and decreased productivity. It is, you know, globally, I think the estimates are around $1 trillion are lost annually because of depression and anxiety. And recent polls have shown that there's been basically a 68% increase in the workplace by people working as far as awareness of depression, and 62% say that they see depression in the workplace regularly. So it's up there, and it's there.
All right, when we talk about the idea of awareness of depression, what about the signs that someone is depressed?
The signs that people are depressed are varied. A lot of times it could be irritability. In fact, a lot of the signs, you know, they talk about adult onset of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, that lack of attention, that inability to concentrate, and being very forgetful. Those are all signs that you could be having depression, as well as withdrawing from social activities, withdrawing, being late to meetings. Simple things like overeating or undereating, any change in diet, any change of sleep, those are all symptoms that can be related to depression.
Mm. And in what ways does alcohol use, substance use, or substance abuse factor into the prevalence, the incidence of depression in the workplace?
What happens with alcohol or drug abuse is oftentimes that's a way that people cope internally because, you know, we have a stigma about mental health issues like depression. So we try to take care of things ourselves. We don't sleep well. So we go and we have a glass of wine before we go to bed. Well, that glass of wine becomes two glasses, then a bottle. And it grows over time and you don't even watch it happen. It just, you know, over time, you wake up one day and, man, I'm having to drink a bottle or two of wine to get to sleep at night. And it becomes thoroughly enmeshed in your everyday life. And individuals oftentimes don't even see that they're doing it.
Hmm. This whole idea of the stigma about mental health issues, some people don't even like to discuss this idea of mental health or different aspects of it. How do we get past that?
Well, Bob, that's a tough situation, a tough conversation in most people's lives because we're afraid of it. I mean, there are some cultures where if you have someone with a mental health disorder, the community believes that you're cursed by God. And so if you have multiple children, you're not going to be able to get your kids married because nobody wants to marry into a cursed family and things like that. So it is taboo in a lot of cultures around the world to talk about it. You know, in the everyday life, we have more and more communication about mental health issues, but it's a lot of lip service. I see millennials, college students today who they talk a good talk. We need to be, you know, open-minded to this. But then when they have a roommate who gets depressed, I've had it 100 times, if I've had it once, where that roommate comes to my office and says something like, well, you know, the minute I said something to my roommates, they all, you know, shunned me and don't say that. You sound crazy. And because we're afraid of it, we don't know enough actual facts about it. And it's going to be a process. It's not a light switch that we can just change that overnight. And we are taking part, you and I mean, you're on WFAN, a sports channel, and you got a psychologist, and I come on there, you know, not every week, but I do come on there a lot. And we talk about mental health issues, and that's what it takes. We have to do it and make it part of our whole world because it is. It's a human thing. It's not a crazy thing.
Millennials. You mentioned millennials earlier in our discussion. I guess the question is, are millennials getting a bad rap?
Yes and no. I have some amazing millennials who work for me, and The problem is that there's a big enough percentage of those millennials that they overrepresent. If we look at society in general, for example, here in Texas, you know, there's about 10% of the people who live here in Texas who fit that stereotypical cowboy attitude. They wear cowboy boots and cowboy hats and, you know, they go ride their horses and things like that. But that's what the rest of the world thinks of when you say Texas. The other 90% are just like everybody else, and they work 9-to-5 jobs. They're living in cities, and they have to deal with commuting back and forth to work and traffic and everything else. Well, the millennials, they have that percentage that represents them, and it overrepresents the majority of the millennials that are out there, but it is a significant number. Instead of 10%, for example, this group of millennials has the highest rate of suicide attempts than any previous generation before them, at roughly 20% attempt rate. So that's 1 in 5 millennials is contemplating and attempting suicide. Not being successful gets you, but attempting.
Now to an interesting area of discussion. We're going to talk about surfing. Yes, I said surfing. Surfing. And some of what I've read in preparation for our discussion today. How can surfing be helpful for someone who is dealing with PTSD or depression, or even some of the very prevalent sleep problems?
Well, you know, talking about destigmatizing mental health, we don't want to go and say, hey, I'm going to my therapy, I'm going to my group session. But if I say I'm going surfing, everybody's like, cool, you know, and you get motivated and pushed to go do that. So you break a barrier by doing that. And a lot of our interactions in this world are artificial. And what I mean by that is, you know, we're animals, we're hunter-gatherers, and we don't spend enough time outdoors and doing the hunting and the chasing and spending time communing with nature. And surfing is an amazing way to do that. It forces you to put down your electronics, because you can't take your cell phone out on the surfboard with you and text your friends and do selfies. And, you know, I know there are a few, you know, people who try to do that with special cameras that are waterproof and stuff, but you know, you're separated from that, and all of a sudden it's you and nature. It's you and millions of gallons of water pounding on top of you. And there's something primal about that is healing and invigorating.
So with this idea of somebody who's dealing with, and there are a lot of people who are dealing with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, in their lives, and unfortunately there are also a lot of veterans who are dealing with this in various forms. Some of them don't even know that that's exactly what they're dealing with.
Exactly.
PTSD, could that actually be helped by this?
Yes, it can. It is reaffirming. It's life reaffirming when you get up on that wave, much like some people use snow skiing the same way. You know, you get up and you go down that steep and you're able to get that exhilaration, and you get into a rhythm with the environment, with our planet, and you're able to then process a lot of your stress and emotion and put things in perspective. And it's so healing to be one with that. So.
Is this something that you recommend to your patients?
Well, we're about 3.5 hours from the ocean here.
Right.
So it's kind of difficult to do the surfing all the time. We do have, believe it or not, a surfing park here in Austin, Texas, where you can come and surf. But you have to, you know, only so many people can surf at a time. You actually have to get reservations. So that may actually be more prevalent as we move through our society, what I encourage my clients to do, because it's something you can do here all the time, is we have lots of access to hike and bike trails, to outdoor activities, camping, fishing, water sports. I also encourage things like martial arts and basketball and, you know, lifetime sports like golf, because it gets you outside and it makes it easier for you to do that connection with the environment, period.
When talking about depression, and we're talking with Dr. John Huber on our program on The Fan this Sunday morning, Sports Edge with Rick Wolf follows our 8 o'clock update. Ed Randall's Talking Baseball's along after our 9 o'clock update. Dr. Huber is the chairman for Mainstream Mental Health, and he's kind enough to be tackling a number of issues with us on our program. When talking about depression, there is some interesting research that talks about a link between social media use and depression. And just saying that, some people probably went, uh-oh. Tell us about that.
Well, social media, you know, it is an interesting phenomenon. We look at the evolution.
That's an understatement, yes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for example, television, you know, it started off very small. We had just a few channels and it was black and white. And it took decades for it to get to where it is today. Social media, virtually overnight, in a period of 10 or 15 years, has become pivotal to everybody's life, whether you're in business, whether you're a high school student, a middle school student, or a middle-aged housewife. It has become enmeshed in our life, and we can't see a life without it right now. That's how we communicate to everybody. Unfortunately for some people, we see everybody else talking about how beautiful and wonderful their life is, because, you know, we don't want a bunch of whiners and crybabies in our society, so we don't talk oftentimes about the difficulty we're having, but we definitely talk about the good times we're having. So when people see all these posts and they think, man, you know, I've been in this job for, you know, the last 40 weeks and I haven't had a break, and these people seem like they're always taking these beautiful vacations. And so you start wallowing in your own despair. How come my life isn't that good? And it's really easy to get tied up in that. Plus, it represents a very unrealistic perfection that we often only get to see, for example, in the movies.
This idea of the attraction that so many people have to these electronic devices, the phone, the tablet, the computer, and to social media, is this an addiction?
Yes, actually, because unlike television, you get to interact with it. And when you interact with it, you post your own stuff up on your Instagram, for example, and somebody clicks on it and says they like it. We've actually measured it, and you're getting the same neurotransmitters responding in your brain, making you feel good, as someone using an addictive substance like heroin or cocaine. So even though it's not as strong, it's continuous and persistent, and it becomes part of your everyday experience, and you just crave that next little bit of that dopamine. Except it's the same kind of thing you get when you see your best friend walking down the hallway, and you get to see them and hug them and shake their hands and ask them, only you're missing the actual physical content. So it's much like a diet soda, where you get the sweetness, but you have none of the nutritional value, even though sodas don't have a lot, but there is some in there. You don't get any of that with social media.
Most interesting discussion with Dr. John Huber on our program. Dr. Huber is chairman for Mainstream Mental Health, mainstreammentalhealth, that's all as one word, .org, the website. Dr. Huber, thank you very much for joining us on our program. Sorry we couldn't get to calls from folks listening to us, but we did cover a couple of different areas that I think were very timely and hopefully provided some good insight for some of the folks as well. You stay well. Thank you for joining us on our program.
Thank you, Bob. As usual, way too short a conversation. It goes by so fast.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.